Hello, I'm Maya Nouns, IISS Senior Fellow for Chinese Security and Defense Policy and host of the IISS Sound Strategic Podcast. And welcome to the first Sound Strategic episode of 2024. Today's discussion is going to examine recent changes in the Indo-Pacific security landscape, from developments in the U.S.-China relationship and how that's being viewed in the region, to Southeast Asian military modernization plans in response to growing Chinese assertiveness, and the potential impacts of recent elections in the region as well. Lastly, we'll zoom into the development of long-range strike capabilities in the Indo-Pacific, the drivers behind it, the challenges to developing it, and the impact this is all having on regional stability. To help me discuss these topics today are Virle Nouwens, Executive Director of the IISS Asia Office, where she plays a key role in organizing the annual IISS Shangri-La Dialogue and provides intellectual direction for IISS research on the Asia-Pacific. Dr. Evan Laxmana, Senior Fellow for Southeast Asian Military Modernization, who specializes in Southeast Asian defense and foreign policy, as well as military change and innovation. And lastly, Tim Wright, Research Associate for Defense and Military Analysis, whose expertise lies in strategic and theater range missiles and arms control. Virle, Evan, and Tim, welcome to the show. So, Virle, the IISS Asia Office recently launched a new program looking at the Indo-Pacific's defense and strategy. I was wondering whether you can give our listeners a quick introduction to this new program.
Sure thing. So we're delighted to have created a new program here at IISS Asia in Singapore, which really looks at regional state-based competition and conflict, developments in hard power, as well as wider geopolitical balances and strategies in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean region. The program consists of myself and Dr. Evan Laxmana, who you'll hear from shortly. Whilst my specialism really is in Chinese foreign policy and kind of regional geopolitics, Evan really gets into the nuts and bolts of Southeast Asian military modernization and procurement, as well as defense industrial relationships across the region. The really great thing about IISS is that we have such close cooperation with other teams across our international offices. One of the projects that we recently completed, which resulted in the long-range strike paper, is no exception to that. So it was great to work together with Tim on that as well.
With regards to this long-range strike paper that you just mentioned, can you maybe give a brief introduction to it and some of the main takeaways before we hand over to Tim later on in the show to go into greater detail?
Basically, in terms of this paper, I think it was fascinating to do because it really, I think, underscores the temperature in the region at the moment. The paper really sought to examine why and how countries in the Asia Pacific are growing their missile arsenals at the rate that they are. Whilst every country is developing their capabilities based on their own national threat perceptions and perspectives, I think it's also true that China and North Korea's expanding inventories, rhetoric, and behavior, of course, to varying extents for each of these, really is driving a sense of instability amongst countries in the region. And so for countries like Australia, Japan, South Korea, they're really looking to develop their own deterrent capabilities in the form of long-range strike as well. They're not the only ones. Others are as well. So we looked at Taiwan, the Philippines, and Vietnam. They're pursuing smaller programs, but pursuing them nonetheless. And they tend to generally be focused on anti-ship capabilities, of course, in response to, from their perspective, China's assertive behavior, particularly the South China Sea. But for all three, I think there's a potential for greater investment in the future, depending on how they perceive regional security to be developing. In addition to these kind of strengths of these programs, there's, of course, also weaknesses. And in this respect, there needs to be what Tim loves to call connective tissue that supports these strike capabilities. And I'm sure he'll go into that later. But as of now, a lot of this still relies on quite a significant heavy lift from the United States and dependence on the United States in the short term.
Aside from long-range strike, what are the other main trends that you're seeing at the moment in regional security and defense?
If I could tie it to long-range strike just a little bit longer, I think that it is clear that there's a sense of instability in the region that's driving this desire to enhance capabilities for deterrence, like I said, whether that be independently or through partnering with others. Of course, the U.S. alliance system being key in that. But I think China's assertiveness does play a role in this, whether it think so itself or not. On the one hand, of course, we see China embarking on more conciliatory partnerships, for example, the Global Security Initiative, as well as through ASEAN as a framework, in addition to, of course, the bilateral relationships that it has. But on the flip side of that, we do see assertive behavior. I think the experiences of the Philippines, for example, in the South China Sea, and particularly around the second Thomas Shoal, can certainly be seen as destabilizing.
And speaking of extra-regional or indeed actors further afield, we see three European navies who will deploy to the Indo-Pacific in 2024 and 2025. Can you give a bit more of a sense of European Indo-Pacific engagement?
Sure. So if we look at, say, naval deployments for the next 2 years, what we do know already with some certainty, of course, is French carrier strike group to be deployed this year, a Dutch frigate to be deployed this year, a German frigate and supply ship this year, and then we can expect the British carrier strike group to re-enter the region. I think all European countries have this underlying rationale that unifies them in terms of why they're coming to this part of the world. Global supply chains, the interdependence between economies, that all directly and indirectly impacts European security should something happen here in this part of the world. I think secondly, with regards to rules of the road, conduct at sea and in the air, I think the application of international law is just that, it's global. And so upholding the rules in one part of the world means upholding them everywhere so that new precedents are not set. And that's, I think, very important for European partners to emphasize as well through their engagement here in Asia. But I think European countries do have their specificity. So France, for example, has extensive population in the Indo-Pacific as well as territories that really add an extra reason for France to be so deeply engaged and so deeply present militarily here. I do think that the debate around Europe being militarily present in the Indo-Pacific has shifted over the years. I think the strategy for this has been fine-tuned as well. I personally would argue that it was never really about being as militarily present as the United States, for example. I think the limited resources of European militaries to be permanently present here drives, I think, quite a bit of, I would say, justified skepticism about the role that they can play. I think the question around sustainability is one that countries are right to ask in this part of the world. I think it's really important for Europe to have long-term goals and visions that they are working towards and that can be clearly communicated to partners in Asia. But I think it's also about finding a niche to fill. And I think European militaries and navies are well placed to do that. I also think that whilst there's a lot of talk about how Europe could contribute to extreme scenarios that we can think of militarily, so say a Taiwan scenario is one that everyone often brings up in terms of what could Europe militarily do in that situation, I think that it's more about Europe trying to fill in provide stability and continued deterrence in subregions of the Indo-Pacific in the event that the United States is strategically focused elsewhere on a specific conflict and diverting its resources and assets to that scenario. So I think these are not insignificant contributions, even if it takes a little bit more effort to explain and to bring home to audiences in Asia.
Maybe moving on to the United States, since you just mentioned it, how is the region responding to the upcoming U.S. elections? Certainly in Europe, we're seeing debate around what the potential for a possible Trump 2.0 administration might mean for European security. What's the view from Asia at the moment?
Trump's first term in office was not necessarily viewed as a particularly constructive one that really engaged with some of the key interests of the region, particularly Southeast Asia, but also others. I think there was also the lack of engagement through senior visits to this part of the world is something that really struck countries here and audiences. And I think depending on who you ask, I think there's also a nervousness of the approach to China. Will Trump, for example, take a stronger, sharper approach than what we've seen under the Biden administration? Even if the Biden administration has also taken quite a tough stance on China, I guess the question is, what will Trump do with this? I think for allies, for example, South Korea and Japan, the emphasis on greater financial contributions or taking on a greater share of that financial burden in the alliance relationship, again, that's something that really struck allies here in this region. That issue of America first is one that I think is on everyone's mind as a key point of Trump's foreign policy. And the expectation is that that probably won't change very much the second time around. I think it's also quite interesting. I mean, you mentioned, of course, the transatlantic relationship. And here, I think it's quite important to also think about the secondary and tertiary knock-on effects of a Trump administration. It's not just about Trump's relationship with countries here in the region. It's also about what the relationship with Europe will mean for this part of the world. What does that mean for European relationships in Asia? What does that mean for, say, Trump's threat to withdraw from NATO or not fund Ukraine? Should that ever happen, that would redirect more resources to the European theater for Europe itself, with less attention perhaps for this part of the world, particularly in security terms. So I think there's more of a complex relationship there to explore.
Evan, maybe moving on to you, Verla just nodded in your direction with regards to how Southeast Asia is looking at the potential of a Trump administration or a second Biden administration following this year's elections. Could you build on that a little bit?
I think that's an interesting point about how different allies and partners think of a future Trump administration. I think certainly countries like Japan and South Korea and Australia are all increasingly nervous if a Trump administration means some of their long-term programs like AUKUS and all of that becomes not as strong as they thought it might. And certainly, you know, Trump's pitch around allies should do more, allies should contribute more, certainly makes that management a lot harder. But outside of those key allies and partners, I think for Southeast Asian states, of course, in this case, the Philippines is a bit different because of what's happening with China over the past year. But outside of the Philippines, I would think that many Southeast Asians are somewhat not as nervous as many would expect. For one thing, there's a myth, I think, among some Southeast Asian countries, including Indonesia, that actually we deal better with a Republican administration who doesn't talk as much about democracy and human rights the way the Democrats would. So in that sense, that's not always a bad thing. Secondly, I think what's challenging is whether or not business groups that are increasingly on the ascendant across Southeast Asia are going to be able to find more transactional rooms to work with the Trump administration. So for us to get the attention of the US, we simply need to do business with the Trump organization, and then that's it. So I think there's a bit of that in their mind. But I do think in general, US credibility when it comes to regional security, I think has always been in question going back as far as the Iraq War anyway. So in that sense, it wouldn't be a surprise that concerns around US military presence will always be there. But I do think that the foundation that the Biden administration has built in terms of exercises, training, arms sales, and so forth across the region, I think should, in theory, outlast one particular president or another, and it should be much more institutionalized as we move forward. But I do think the region has seen this playbook before with the Trump administration and is perhaps a bit more ready this time around rather than the first time around.
And of course, there's also elections happening within the region itself. I was wondering whether you could speak a little bit to what we can expect from, for example, a new leader in Indonesia, amongst other results coming out later this year.
I think Southeast Asia has certainly been undergoing its own generational transition over the past 2 or 3 years, and it's likely to continue for the next few. We've had a transition in Cambodia last year, and then Malaysia as well, and Indonesia this year, and then likely Singapore soon before 2025. What's interesting about these political transitions is, number one, the old model of how Southeast Asian leaders know each other and work each other and trust each other well, I think that model is increasingly being replaced by less personal bureaucratic engagements, particularly through ASEAN, and it's about 1,300 meetings a year. So that sort of personal touch, I think, is something that Southeast Asia is still trying to rediscover with this new generation of leaders. And when I say new generation, I don't mean younger, because certainly Prabowo, as the president-elect of Indonesia, cannot be classified as young in that sense. But he is certainly part of a new generation of leaders that's stepping into the role with a much more complicated political coalition, including major businesses. So in that sense, I think in the case of Indonesia in particular, while you will likely see a mood and momentum presidency by Prabowo, you will also see an effort to hedge even harder from a U.S.-China standpoint. Certainly, Prabowo's tenure as defense minister demonstrates his close relationship with Western powers on defense procurement, exercises, and training. But Prabowo's coalition, when he ran for office, was also very much filled by major business groups with a strong relationship with China, particularly on the energy sector, which will still be a key feature of a probable administration moving forward. So you will see an even more expansive economic relationship with China, as well as a more expansive security relationship with the US. But the real challenge is whether or not, amidst all of this, amidst the political transition across generations, amidst the hedging harder with US and China, to what extent will this mean a decline in the utility of ASEAN as a regional grouping to manage these geopolitical uncertainties?
You just spoke of a closer relationship between Indonesia and China economically, but of course, in the last year and a bit before that, actually, we've been focusing on increasing PLA assertiveness in areas like Southeast Asia. So how are countries like Indonesia responding to that assertiveness by the Chinese military?
I think that's a great question, because I do think what's happening with the Philippines is sort of an outlier in the sense that it's very frequent, it's quite acute in terms of the threat environment, and the crises are not just once or twice, but it's recurring multiple times over the last year or so. What is not clear is whether or not the rest of Southeast Asia, who also have felt Chinese coercion in the past, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Indonesia, are also seeing what's happening in the Philippines as a prelude to their own future relationship with China. And my sense is, I don't think they feel the same way. I don't think that Malaysia, Indonesia, and Vietnam feels that their fate is going to follow the trajectory of the Philippines. They felt that they at least managed to deal with China in a more private manner, and they can still assert their rights without raising what in Southeast Asia is called megaphone diplomacy. I'm not sure that's a sustainable approach, but that's how the leaders think about it right now. We see this in Malaysian leader statement in the past month or so, that he basically said that there is no problem with China. And of course, that's not true at the operational level, but at the political level, that's how the leaders see it. So they don't feel they share the same fate as the Philippines have now with China. If and when the time comes for Indonesia, for Malaysia, for Vietnam to find themselves again being confronted with Chinese coercion, they will feel the same set of problems, as in they know they cannot respond militarily as much as they would like to. Their economic ties will always complicate any broader strategic reaction. And so therefore, I think their first instinct is probably going back to their default playbook, which is to try and address these problems behind closed doors rather than putting it out there for the world to see.
Pearl already mentioned a little bit about procurement in terms of missile capabilities in the region. Can you talk a little bit more about what procurement trends you're seeing across Southeast Asia, and if you want, the wider region as well at the moment? What are you focusing on?
I think what's interesting about defense procurement across the region is certainly for Southeast Asia, one thing that keeps coming up is this notion of weaning themselves off Russian equipment. We try hard to find these kind of intent, at least being articulated by countries like Vietnam in particular, whose majority of arms and equipment goes back to the Cold War era. Now, there's a debate between policymakers and analysts about the extent and how fast can Vietnam actually do this. But it's not an easy choice, because Vietnam's instinct is always trying to be much more autonomous and have their own major defense companies potentially supply their military. But this trend about partner reliability and diversity, I think, is still there. But the region as a whole, I think Southeast Asia, outside of countries like Singapore and Vietnam, tends to be very diverse in terms of their foreign partners. Indonesia, for example, is one of the most diversely supplied armed forces in the region, with about 33 countries providing major platforms and arms and equipment, which makes, yes, there is no single country that can exercise veto, but also makes it very much harder for them to work out interoperability, cost, maintenance, and so forth. A second trend I think that's crucial for procurement across the region is the need to develop defense industrial bases. So you will see major procurement contracts will always have some form of offset policies attached to it, some form of transfer of technology, joint ventures, supply chain negotiations that I think remains part of about four or five major long-term modernization plans from countries like Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines. They all have some form of offset and long-term modernization plans attached to it. in general, I think Southeast Asian states are very much a long-term retail player on the procurement market. I can only afford to pay a certain amount every year, but I will do this over the next 10 years if you give me a chance to work with some of the offset stuff. So long-term retail, I think, is the name of the game. Outside of Southeast Asia, I think countries like Japan, South Korea, Australia is very much thinking along the lines of interoperability. With the US, Australia has even increased the standard from interoperability to interchangeability. And so procurement needs, I think, will be very much driven by coalition warfighting interoperability down the line as well. That's a lot more complicated because of the different threat environment and starting bases for some of these US allies and partners.
So as you mentioned, these changes are not going to be quick and they might not be easy either. So what do countries do in the meantime? And, you know, I note that crisis management has been an increasingly focused on topic over the past few years. What trends are you seeing in that area?
We all focus on US-China crisis management as the first order of business, because if those two militaries cannot talk to each other in the region, that's certainly a problem for the rest of the region. But quietly, I do think everyone is trying to build their own set of direct communication channels and crisis management mechanisms. Some, I think, more successful than others. ASEAN, for example, at the defense minister's level, has tried to develop an ASEAN direct communications infrastructure that it's trying to extend to its dialogue partners for the last few years. I think only Japan and Australia, I believe, has signed off on that. I do think the instinct to maintain multilateral crisis management is still there, whether it's at the East Asia Summit level or the ASEAN Regional Forum level. But something at the practical level from the bilateral side of things, I think, have grown. We see this between Vietnam and the Philippines earlier this year, for example. In the absence of immediate military capabilities coming their way, I think Southeast Asian states have no choice but to try and develop either stronger multilateral mechanisms or at least entertain the notion of minilateral arrangements with a smaller set of countries. We see this in particular with the Philippines, who was not only doubling down on its alliance with the United States, but also expanding its minilateral arrangements with Japan, with Australia, as well as with other countries. So I think the region's search for partner diversity is certainly a byproduct of the increasingly polarizing strategic competition between the U.S. in China.
Moving on to Tim. Tim, Verla already mentioned, of course, the long-range strike report that you were a co-author on and gave some of the main takeaways. But I was wondering whether you can speak a little bit more specifically about the trends that you are seeing in long-range strike capability development in the Indo-Pacific region.
And there are two main trends that we are seeing of countries seeking to improve their capabilities in the region. I think that's really around range and also ability to hold at risk distant targets. And I especially think that that's true of land-based targets. And this has already been touched upon, so I hope I don't go over too much ground, but you know, China and the DPRK are the foundations for much of this, considering their much larger and more established missile programs, which they're both deepening and widening. This is really driving lots of countries' then reactions in response. Just to focus a little bit, though, on China and DPRK for a moment, talking about, you know, improving range and improving sort of ability to hold at risk distant targets, we can see China is developing a new intermediate range ballistic missile called the DF-27, which has got a hypersonic glide vehicle warhead. It's massively expanding the number of brigades that are equipped with the DF-41 ICBM, and also it's filling three large silo fields in western China that were discovered in 2021. China's also expanded its number of DF-26 missiles that it operates, and has pretty much eliminated the DF-21 medium-range ballistic missile, which is often called a carrier killer. DPRK also has a very active missile program. Most of this goes down to foundations that Kim Jong-un laid out in January 2021 at the 8th Workers' Party Congress. And essentially he gave like a missile and nuclear wish list of different types of systems that he wanted DPRK to develop, such as a land attack cruise missile, a solid fuel ICBM, and also multiple independently targetable re-entry vehicles. And we see North Korea has made good progress on developing various different types of those systems. Now, in response to that, we then see countries within the wider region, but especially within the US alliance framework, so Australia, Japan, and South Korea, are then responding to these developments and are procuring either from their allies or developing systems of their own in response. So as an example, on the procurement, Australia will procure around 200 Tomahawk land attack cruise missiles. Japan will be doing the same as well, but a large number of 400. And this will give both of these countries the ability, really for the first time, using missiles at least, to be able to strike distant targets. Tomahawk's got around a 1,600 kilometer range. Now, for Japan especially, this is a serious step change from the limitations of its post-war constitution that restricts its ability to possess offensive systems. While these countries are procuring systems from their allies, mostly the United States, they're also developing to varied amounts their own systems as well. Japan is developing a whole suite of land, sea, and air launch systems. Australia is seeking technology transfers, especially from the United States, so it can produce some US-designed systems itself. And is acting actually in a bit of a junior role in co-developing some of these systems with the US. And this includes a hypersonic cruise missile, which is very originally known as the hypersonic attack cruise missile, and also a new type of SRBM called the precision strike missile. South Korea has a very active ballistic and cruise missile program, and they've produced numerous different variants across all the different domains, so many so that actually I don't think it's worth me going into detail. Also, just very then briefly, because Evan's already touched on ASEAN, we've also got to then think about this as well. It's not just the US security allies that are producing these systems, and we see ASEAN member states doing this as well. So we've mentioned the Philippines, so they're procuring several batteries of a Indian-Russian co-developed anti-ship missile called the BrahMos. Vietnam is seeking to develop an indigenous version of the Russian Kar-35 anti-ship missile, and Indonesia has procured Turkish-designed SRBMs known as Bora.
So it sounds like there's lots happening in this space, and it also sounds like the development of long-range strike capabilities are potentially going to grow further. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, I think that is. I think you're seeing countries in the region, as I say, really being driven by what's going on in China and North Korea. And unless there is a serious change in how those countries approach some very sensitive topics in the region, whether that's on the South China Sea, whether that's North Korea regularly issuing threats to South Korea, Japan, and the United States as well, I don't think really that's going to then mean that there's going to be any slowing down of procuring these capabilities. And I think we can draw some parallels as well to what is happening in Europe and looking at the war in Ukraine and countries looking at that and then taking lessons from that conflict. I think that's especially true in the sense of the fact that missiles do have a useful deterrent capability. We've seen that demonstrated very clearly, for example, in the Black Sea, where the Ukrainians used an indigenously developed missile called the Neptune, which is a variant of a Russian missile called the Kar-35, which I've mentioned Vietnam already possesses, and that managed to sink the Black Sea cruiser, the Moskva. And then that's also then sort of reshaped the naval game as well in the Black Sea area. And I think countries with maritime disputes in the South China Sea with China will be looking at that and saying, look, here's the deterrent value of long-range anti-ship missile capabilities. Seeing that as well with how Ukraine has used land attack cruise missiles to target Russian command and control, port facilities and so on to disrupt Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Again, I think countries in the region will be looking at this sort of real-time usage and seeing the use of these systems. I think as well they'll probably also be thinking a little bit about how many of these systems do we need? Do we need to buy more than we thought? Do we need to develop more than we thought? Again, because thinking of in a conflict like Ukraine, where we're seeing very large expenditure of munitions, that the countries will think perhaps our inventories need to be deeper than we imagine them to be. European countries are already having this conversation, and I reckon that this is something that probably will be happening in many Asian capitals as well.
And so what challenges do countries face in developing some of these capabilities? Rella flagged the connective tissue issue.
With the connective tissue one, so I mean, what I mean by this is linking sensors to shooters. Although many countries in the region are developing the missiles or buying the missiles, I think there's been less attention from those capitals and also from analysts as well on what's happening and everything between that. And so what I mean by that is things like ISR and command and control, integration, and so on. We are seeing some countries in the region try to sort of bridge this gap. Japan, I think, is quite an interesting example. It's already got quite a well-developed, commercial space sector. And Japan then wants to launch around 10 satellites that it can use to monitor the DPRK. These ISR space-based capabilities will be very important then for trying to sort of identify targets, conduct battle damage assessment, and so on like that. We see South Korea is also trying to do that as well. South Korea has recently launched its first military satellite, again, with the intention that it'll be used to monitor North Korea. But then looking at things like joining up commands, I mean, I think that's another challenge as well, which some countries in the region have already got to grips with, and others are trying to do it now. So South Korea, for example, restructured its missile command in 2022 for the Missile Strategic Command. Japan is looking to establish a joint command by the end of March 2025. So there are some efforts of countries in the region to try to think about how we link all these different sort of parts of our armed forces together. So if they need to use then weapons from all of these different commands to then target an adversary, we are seeing some attempt at doing that. But I think it's still something that's a little bit further away.
And so how does all of this challenge or bolster regional stability in the Indo-Pacific at the moment, do you think? If we zoom out, what do you think the picture looks like?
It will undoubtedly alter the missile landscape in the region. And from a proliferation standpoint, that looks bad. More countries in the region will have more missiles. But that is predicated on the assumption that missile proliferation is inherently bad, and one could argue that it is not. I think given China's and the DPRK's actions in the region, whether it's aggressive patrolling in the South China Sea or the interdiction or the sort of blocking of other countries going through their territorial waters, or North Korea using very destabilizing rhetoric about being in a state of war with its neighbors and threatening to unleash sort of nuclear war on them, improving their capabilities will actually hopefully be stabilizing, as will improve deterrence. And this will hopefully then avert military adventurism by China or thinking in the DPRK that it could use nuclear coercion against South Korea or potentially the United States.
That's all we have time for today. So thank you, Virla, Evan, and Tim for sharing your insights. And thank you all for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. For more in-depth analysis, visit the IISS website and follow the IISS on X and LinkedIn. You can find more information in our show notes, including a link to the recently published IISS research report titled Long-Range Strike Capabilities in the Asia-Pacific, Implications for Regional Stability. Please do follow, rate, and subscribe to Sound Strategic wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts to keep up to date with all the latest episodes. Thank you and see you next time.